Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Coming up, we're going to speak to an Iraqi translator for Americans who's now found safety and a new life as a refugee here in the U.S. But first, developments maybe in the standoff between Britain and Iran over that British naval crew seized by Iran's Revolutionary Guard back on March 23rd. An Iranian diplomat taken 2 months ago by uniformed gunmen in Iraq has been released and is now back in Iran. And Iraqi officials say they're seeking the release of 5 other Iranians detained there by the U.S. military. At his news conference today, President Bush said there should be no quid pro quo when it comes to hostages. Well, Reuters chief correspondent Edmund Blair joins us from Tehran. And Edmund, are there any dots to be connected here between the release of the Iranian diplomat, the work towards releasing the other Iranians, and the British crew being held in Iran? You know, the president said no quid pro quo, but are we watching one develop?
Well, I think it's difficult to draw too many conclusions from this. I mean, there's no official link. I guess the kind of possible link that some would point to is that the Revolutionary Guards who seized the Britons, some say they may have acted to send a message to the West that that as long as they were holding Iranians in Iraq, Iran would not sit by and do nothing.
We heard yesterday from Borzu Daragahi of the Los Angeles Times, also there in Tehran where you are, that with the end of a recent holiday, more moderates are returning to the area, more moderate newspapers will begin publishing, and in fact the voices against the seizure of the British sailors will be heard more loudly. Are you hearing that?
I think we will get other voices being heard. We had one or two sort of hints of that today. We had a newspaper saying that, well, this was a British plot. The British are always blamed for many things in Iran. But a moderate saying that this was a British plot. But on the other hand, saying that that counselling caution. But it was a very, very carefully worded saying, suggesting that wise heads should prevail, and we shouldn't do anything to provoke others. So I think we will hear different voices, but it's very difficult to see how those voices can come out strongly when the issue really is part of, has been presented as an issue of national pride.
Well, British Prime Minister Tony Blair says the next 2 days are fairly critical to resolving this dispute, which is of course why, you know, we're looking with interest at the release of the Iranian diplomat. But do you know what else he might have meant about the next 2 days?
British officials say that they were trying to resolve this quietly, but when they found they were getting nowhere, they escalated the issue. Perhaps there's a sense, again, that this is a time to try and take a more softly approach, but then, again, if it doesn't yield a result, then perhaps it will get escalated again. But it's difficult to see what the precise deadline would be. I suspect it's just a case for driving things forward as fast as possible.
Well, meanwhile, the Iranian news agency issued a new picture of the British crew. We thought the Iranian government said they were going to refrain from issuing pictures. What does that say to you?
I think some of the images that do appear to have come out are really aimed at least from the Iranian point of view, and that this is the message that they are trying to give and say they are trying to give, is that they're trying to say, look, we're not treating them badly. We're treating them very well. They're eating enough food, and they're all perfectly happy as they could be given the circumstances, so don't worry about them. There may be some might say even that's an element of cultural misunderstanding here. The Iranians think that they are actually doing a good thing by ensuring the families won't worry, whereas the West interprets this as a sort of a stage-managed propaganda. There may be an element of that.
One last thought for you, Edmund Blair. The Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, was supposed to hold a news conference to speak about the situation. Has that happened yet?
No, that's been postponed today. There's been no official reason. Apparently, the statement said that the media had requested him not to hold the press conference today. It's not exactly clear why the media would have made that request. It certainly is true that in the past, Ahmadinejad's statements, at least diplomats would say, have often muddied the waters of diplomacy over, say, the nuclear issue, and some speculate that perhaps there was an endeavour to ensure that that did not happen again. But largely this is speculation, and it's difficult to draw too many conclusions as the press conference has only been postponed 24 hours.
Edmund Blair, chief correspondent for Reuters, speaking to us from Tehran. Edmund, thank you.
Okay, cheers.
To our conversation today with an Iraqi refugee. Approximately 2 million Iraqis have fled their country since the 2003 invasion. They've relocated mainly to Syria and Jordan, but less than 500 Iraqis have been allowed to resettle in the U.S. In February, the Bush administration changed that policy, so now an additional 7,000 Iraqis a year who are living in Jordan, Syria, and Turkey will be granted refugee status in the U.S. Today, the story of a young woman who's come ahead of that wave. When American reconstruction teams arrived in Baghdad in May of 2003, 30-year-old Asma Abdi approached them and asked for a job as a translator. She worked for the Americans for 4 years before coming to the States last month under a new visa that will allow 50 former translators from Iraq and Afghanistan into the U.S. each year. And Asma joins us in the studio now. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you're here in the studio because we also have with us Jerry Burke. He's a retired Massachusetts State Police trooper, one of the first people sent to Baghdad to advise police forces there. And Asma was his translator in Iraq. Jerry, I want to start with you, because when you were here last in January, you made a plea, you know, to help people like Asma get here. How worried were you for her then, and what does it feel now that she's arrived?
Well, I was very worried for her and many of the other Iraqis that we worked with, interpreters and for the Iraqi police officers. Their association with the Americans puts them in danger of being assassinated. In fact, a young man who I had working with me, who actually grew up in the United States, he was born in Iraq but grew up in the United States, and he loved working with us. And unfortunately, one morning on the way to work, he was assassinated at a bus stop. So it's a very real danger that the not just the interpreters but the police officers face just for working with the Americans.
Asma, how badly did you want to leave? This is your country, you know, and so I'm wondering how conflicted you were about how badly you wanted to come here.
Last year, the situation get bad, and I felt I'm not secure anymore, and I could be targeted for any reason. Could be my sect, could be by going to work and an explosion occurred in the road. Or it could be because I'm a translator. Hmm. So either way, I want to run away.
Do you know people who were killed for being translators?
Yeah, a lot.
Really?
A lot of my friends, a lot of pictures. If I brought the pictures, you will see a lot of people have been killed. I told my family, like, expect I could be killed in any moment. So I don't want you to get sad or depressed. So all of us, we worked with Americans, not because of the job, not because of the salary, but because we have the dream, we want to achieve something, to build our country, and to have our own home. But finally, like me and a lot of translators, right now we want to run away.
Did you find people, as the temper and the mood started to change, were friends asking you, what are you doing? Or people asking you, what are you doing?
As I work as a translator?
Yeah.
I didn't tell anyone that I'm working as a translator.
Oh, so it was a secret?
Yeah.
Complete secret.
From first beginning, because not all the people are agreeing about the existence of American. And some people disagree, some people agree. Everyone had his own opinion. And at the time, there was no government. I mean, there is no law enforcement. So it's kind of a critical situation. So I prefer to keep it quiet instead of to everyone, announce it.
Jerry, talk about the work you guys did together. You know, she's just been here for a while now, but do you find yourself thinking back to times that you had in Iraq?
Yeah, well, of course, we reminisce a lot about driving around the city of Baghdad in, you know, sort of the good old days when it was a lot more permissive. Mm-hmm. I would drive the vehicle myself frequently and sometimes by myself to go to the police academy, but other times I'd drive with her. I'd be the driver, she'd be sitting beside me, and we'd go out to visit the police stations. And we didn't need a convoy. We didn't need armored Humvees with us. Eventually, I got a couple of Iraqi police officers as drivers and bodyguards. So I was able to sit in the back seat behind tinted windows. But we still managed to go to every police facility in the city many times and, you know, go to restaurants. We've been to the Iraqi hunting club in Baghdad, and we've been to restaurants on the Tigris River on Abu Nawas Street. And we really enjoyed the city at the beginning. And unfortunately, around August of 2003, when the UN building got bombed, that was sort of a symbolic change, and security became a lot more difficult.
What kinds of words did she provide for you? I mean, what was the kind of exchange that
she
would help you with?
She became not just a translator, but sort of a bilingual, bicultural advisor, so that if I went into a meeting with the general officers on the Iraqi police service and I was trying to get across some concepts of policing in a democracy, after the meeting, in the car on the way back to the hotel or off to another police station, I'd ask her, you know, did General so-and-so seem to understand what I was talking about? Sometimes she'd say, well, he was distracted because they tried to blow up the station yesterday. He really wasn't listening. So, you know, she'd give me advice on some of the personalities I was dealing with. And then also, as we entered, for example, Ramadan, they would fast from sun up till sunset, and then they have their evening meal. Well, by 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when you haven't eaten or had any water during the day, you might not be paying as much attention, and you might be a little bit fatigued. Well, she'd explain that General so-and-so probably isn't listening well because he's ready for a nap or he hasn't eaten all day.
Asma, can you remember a moment where you're thinking, oh, Jerry Burke, you are just heading in the wrong direction?
There were probably many of those moments.
You think of a time when you were watching him, an American, do something that just you knew you had to help.
Yeah, like sometimes he used to drink in front of people in Ramadan.
Alcohol, drinking water even
water.
Can be offensive.
Oh. Because it needs a lot of fluids because Iraq is so hot country. So in the beginning, for me, it's okay. I mean, I understand the concept, but maybe others, because police duties like standing long hours in the street or have a lot of duties, carrying a lot of burdens. So it was not nice to drink in front of any person. Just like a few things, like don't shake hands with women. Tell him, like, what happened. Sometimes a few things, he should, like an American, an advisor, he should be aware of what's going on. And plus, like, he's asking me about a few culture things or habits or some regulation in Iraq. Because in each country, you have certain policies and regulation. How is life before the war? How is police system was working? How is functioning? The method of the corruption before the war and after the war. Just make a comparison, because I was working for the government before, and I have a little bit knowledge.
You stop abruptly, and I'm wondering if, you know, you're hearing what I'm hearing, or Jerry Burke, you're hearing what I'm hearing, that given that these are the conversations she had with you, she would have been in a lot of danger there.
She was in danger every day, not just riding around the city with me, but getting to and from work and at night. There was always the possibility that walking into one of these police stations, that one of the policemen who was anti-American or had anti-American sentiments might recognize her and want to take it out and kill her, have her family disrupted.
That's Jerry Burke, former Massachusetts state trooper who worked as an advisor to Iraqi police forces. He's talking about Asma Abdi, who worked as his translator in Iraq, has just arrived here in Boston under a new visa for translators who work with Americans in Afghanistan and Iraq. So Asma's made it here, but right now she's living in Jerry's house. She now faces the daunting task of making a life for herself. We want to ask her more about that. And this note later in the show, Venezuela's ambassador to the U.S. on the tense relations between the two countries. That's all after a quick break, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with Asma Abdi, a 30-year-old Iraqi woman who just gained refugee status and came to the U.S. last month. And also with us, Jerry Burke. And if you just joined us, Jerry advised Iraqi police after the war, and Asma was his translator. And Jerry had been trying for months to help Asma escape the violence in Iraq. He was helping her apply for a student visa. But then Asma ended up getting a special new visa. It's been set up for translators who worked with Americans. And she's now living with Jerry's family in the Boston area until she can get settled. Asma, this is the first time you've been to the U.S., but your father went to college in Florida, so you've certainly heard about it. Has the U.S. been what you expected?
I was not shocked that much. It's only maybe the city is so big.
Oh, you're here in Boston.
Yeah, I'm Boston, and I spent 2 days in New York with some other families. So it was like I was not shocked, because I worked with the Americans most of the time for 4 years.
But now what? You know, now what?
I'm trying right now to find a job, settled. Then the coming few years, I will apply for university. I would like to have my master and PhD. I would like my dad proud of me. Like, I miss him right now. I find him in jury. Jerry know my father. He came to my house several times, Friday lunch. And my dad trusts Jerry, and he, like, I'm a Muslim, but I consider Jerry just like a godfather for me.
Probably the sense of having shared a foxhole kind of mentality that, you know, we survived a lot of, you know, not imminent danger, but a very, you know, tense environment, and we have developed a, you know, good friendship.
Do you feel responsible? In other words, do you think it was your responsibility to get her out?
Yeah, in some ways it was. I just wish that I could take credit for it, that, you know, I provided moral support perhaps, but she did all of the paperwork and all of the running around in the between Baghdad and then eventually going over to Amman, Jordan, because you cannot file for the visa in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. You have to go to Amman, Jordan to file the application, and she did all of that herself.
I mean, the hard part was getting out, but now comes the second hard part.
Well, this is actually probably going to be harder, trying to, you know, find her a job that's suitable. And she has, a little bit of a learning curve, cultural and social issues. Talking about how I mentioned the yellow pages the other day to her. Well, they don't have yellow pages or phone books in Iraq. And, you know, I let that one go by because it's not an important issue right now. But there's a lot of little nuances to American culture. She's going to have to get an apartment of her own, and eventually she wants to go back to school. And she's going to have to do what many of us have done, is balance work and life and education together.
Right. We understand, Asma, you have a bachelor's degree in physical education, one in English literature.
Mm-hmm.
You did get accepted somewhere?
She's been accepted here at Boston University at Sargent College for the master's program in occupational therapy. The problem is, however, that the cost of, you know, tuition and living in Boston is so high that she has to find a job first. That's going to have to be her first priority. Mm-hmm. But she is looking forward to, she actually compared Boston University and Baghdad University.
The other day we went to Boston University. It was lovely, just like Baghdad University. We went there, we worked, me and Jory, and the campus is just like Baghdad. I mean, students rushing, getting to their classes. After that, they grouped to have something to eat, and it's located on the river.
Baghdad is on the Tigris. Boston University here in Boston, across the street from us, is on the Charles.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel now? Do you feel like, oh, great new chapter, or I'm lost, or I miss my family? I mean, what are the...
It's mixed feeling. First, I miss my family. I miss Iraq. I wish the best to Iraq. I wish, like, everything is stable, but I'm happy I'm here. I want to proceed forward. I want to do something like my dad and my mom are proud of me. And every day, like, I'm going to interview, trying to find and contact people. Maybe they know some people can help me to find a job. And plus, reading a lot, improving my English, reading a lot of magazines and newspaper, watching TV, the debate between Democrats and Republicans. Mm-hmm. I'm into, in order to make it easy for me to blend with American community. I don't want to be a stranger here. I'm just, like, looking forward, but at the same time, I miss my dad and mom. Mm-hmm. And I wish in this moment they are with me.
Do you see yourself going back someday? Or do you think this has got to be it for you because of what you did?
I have a dream that Iraq will be safe one day. And part of me wants to return back, but at the same time, I want to proceed forward. I want to blend with this community. I told you, it's mixed feeling.
Yeah.
I cannot decide. But at the same time, like my mom and dad, when I call them, like, just proceed forward. We trust you. You know, we know that you will do the right thing.
Well, what do you think about the fact that you are here and so many thousands have applied and haven't been able to get here? I mean,
I'm lucky. I mean, I admit I'm a lucky person to be here. And there is a lot of thousands of Iraqi, whether they work with Americans or they are refugees, because of their sect. So I consider myself as lucky, but I sympathize with the people. I will not forget they are Iraqi just like me. We are sharing blood. They are far away, and they are suffering. The other countries will kick them sooner or later, and they do not have jobs. They do not have income. It's always outcome. They have to pay for resident visa, a lot of things. I saw many Iraqis in Jordan. They are suffering a lot. They didn't put their children in a school. I mean, this is worse. I mean, the next generation will be miserable. I mean, I am asking for anyone to, who can help the Iraqis, whether refugees, whether they are in Iraq. And it's painful.
Asma Abdi is a translator from Iraq who recently came to the U.S. under a special visa program for Iraqi and Afghan translators who did work with U.S. forces as she did, and she worked with Jerry Burke, a retired Massachusetts State Police trooper who advised Iraqi police forces. Jerry, Asma, I want to thank you both for speaking to us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Okay, a quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, is global warming causing the spread of dengue fever in Mexico or worse allergies in Atlanta? One of the world's foremost experts in infectious diseases will talk about the connection between climate change and public health. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, why loving a dog inevitably teaches you about loss. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This week, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez warned that his government might take over private hospitals if their prices continue to go up. Chavez is called the second liberator of the Republic, after Simon Bolivar, by his supporters, an evolving dictator by his detractors. He's already nationalized electric and telecom companies, as well as the country's most lucrative oil projects. And that has Washington worried because Venezuela is the fourth largest oil supplier to the U.S. Well, joining us on his cell phone is the Venezuelan ambassador to the U.S., Bernardo Alvarez Herrera. He's in New England to give a lecture tomorrow night at Brown University on U.S.-Venezuelan diplomatic relations. Mr. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you very much for having us.
Well, in his visit to five Latin American countries last month, I'm sure you're aware that President Bush didn't seem to mention President Chavez's name once. And Chavez has called President Bush a political cadaver, cosmic dust, and at the UN last year, an alcoholic and the devil. So how would you characterize U.S.-Venezuelan relations?
Well, President Chavez was recently on TV here, and he even said that if it is necessary, he would apologize.
Do you think he should apologize? I mean, some say
No. What he's saying is, he's trying to explain the U.S. people why he's doing that. Who caused more problems? You, because you called somebody a name, and we have been called also everything, or somebody who is dropping bombs and invading countries. So who is really harming more the world?
Well, as you say, the language has gone both ways. There was an evangelical leader in the U.S. who said that Chavez should be assassinated.
Yes.
But do you think that Chavez's rhetoric has been damaging to Venezuelans? There were boycotts here in the U.S. of gas from Citgo, the Venezuelan subsidiary. One Boston city councilor proposed taking down the Citgo sign that's here on the Boston skyline. Do you think it's been damaging?
Well, but on the other hand, you have a lot of hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. that they have said that they appreciate what we are doing with the U.S.
This is Venezuela's program giving oil to low-income people. There's a program here in the Boston area and elsewhere. Some people, some politicians have said that, first of all, the people who accept that oil from Venezuela are being unpatriotic because of the tense situation between the U.S. and Venezuela. And others have said that this is a gimmick on the part of Venezuela.
Well, let me tell you, let me stress with you. I mean, it might be difficult relations between the administration of this country and Venezuelan government, but we don't have problem with the U.S. people at all. I mean, we Venezuelan imports from the U.S. has grown from $4.5 billion in 2005 to $8.5 billion in 2006. So this is in only 1 year. That means U.S. job, U.S. We keep supplying the U.S. with more than a million barrels per day of products that we refine here through Citgo and that we refine in Venezuela. So if you see what we have done to the U.S., and actually we are doing a lot of very, very good things for the U.S.
Why do you think U.S. leaders, the current administration, don't like Hugo Chavez?
Because I think they think that Hugo Chavez, and they might be right, represent a radical change in Latin America. I mean, Hugo Chavez is not an accident. Chavez was seen as, you know, as the new Fidel, etc.
Well, and there's also the idea of, you know, capitalism versus socialism, and those who embrace, you know, the free market and capitalism in U.S. leadership see Chavez's governing as 21st century socialism. He claimed he was going to spread the wealth among Venezuelans, but as you know, he's been criticized lately. His nationalizing of the telecommunications, electric and oil industries, he refused to license one of Venezuela's oldest broadcast outlets. Some of his critics are saying that's not socialism. He's feeling more like a dictator.
Yeah, well, this is one thing doesn't have anything to the other. These two companies, you said, we renationalize them because one in the telecommunication, they want to sell it and we want to buy it. And that was a very transparent commercial operation with due process and fair compensation, and exactly the same with electricity. And we said from the very beginning that for some strategic industries, it's important for us to have the control, because at the end we have to guarantee a public service. And you know, this is not dictatorship. We have done that through the law, we have done that through the Constitution.
Well, you know that he's pushing for changes to allow him indefinite re-election. There's a pro-Chavez parliament that's given him the ability to rule by decree for 18 months. And we read that middle-class Venezuelans are queuing up to leave the country. They're you know, applying for visas at double the amount of a few months ago.
Okay. Well, if we want to go through a process of re-election, indefinite re-election for all elected officials, not only for the President of the Republic, we have to change the Constitution. And in order to do that, we have to propose changes in the Constitution, and then we have to go into a national referendum where Venezuelans people will vote whether they agree or not with that changes.
I guess, Mr. Ambassador...
You have to have the whole picture, you see.
I guess, Mr. Ambassador, we're asking, do you think that Venezuelans are voting with their feet? Even some of Chavez's own supporters are balking at his plan to form one political party to support him. A couple of pro-Chavez groups have refused to join. Do you think, you know, he might pull back a little on this idea of increased state control because of some of the reactions that you're seeing in your country?
No, I think it's difficult here in this country that people try to understand that there is a new reality. So people is, like you are doing, is only reacting to critiques and things that, I mean, we don't have any problem to address and to live with that. But there is a completely different situation, new leadership. This is a new set of policies. It's a new relation between the state, parties. There is a new wave of political participation coming from the bottom up to in society. So those are new, completely new realities that the problem is, if you keep having the mentality of the free trade and the, only the liberal democracy as the model that you will want to export all over the world, you will never understand what is going on in our country. So I think we should better, I mean, sit down, look what is going on in Latin America, and the only way to have a very productive relationship between the U.S. and the rest of Latin America is to understand those new realities.
What do you mean? I mean, what's your definition of the new reality in Venezuela and Latin America?
Well, there is an explosion of popular participation. There is the search of a new kind of democratic process away from the classical elite type of democracies that we had in Venezuela. But what for me is the most important thing is this awakening of society and popular participation of people in all the aspects of social life in my country.
Bernardo Alvarez Herrera, Venezuelan ambassador to the U.S., visiting in New England. Mr. Ambassador, first of all, welcome to New England, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, still to come before we go, poet and essayist Mark Doty asks, what is it about dogs? You're listening to Here and Now. When John and Elizabeth Edwards announced that her cancer had returned and that they would continue on with his presidential campaign, many people marveled, some criticized, and in both groups, people empathized. A lot of couples face the question, what happens when one partner gets sick? As health columnist Judy Foreman writes about the Edwards, his career, her health, not an easy balancing act. Well, Judy knows from when she speaks, and she joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
And we want to remind listeners they can read your column. They can go to our website, here-now.org, and there they'll find out, you know, that you write from experience. Your husband, who recently died, what were his illnesses?
Well, he has had, or he had had a lymphoma for 11 years, which was pretty much under control, and then 5 or 6 years ago, he got prostate cancer, and that was always the bigger threat to his health, and that's what he eventually died of.
No, just, you know, and our sympathy.
Thank you.
Again.
Thank you.
But, you know, you write at the beginning of your column that you had to strike a deal on how to live with cancer. What was that deal?
Oh, there were many deals, actually. You have to kind of balance your own needs against the partner who has a disease. And I should say, you know, he wasn't sick the whole time. He had a diagnosis. And so we could sort of go in and out of denial. And we had to balance, essentially, my fears of losing him with his need to kind of maintain normalcy.
Right. You say he had a need, which was sometimes tough for you, to minimize things.
That's
to
right.
Remain fiercely independent. You were more emotional, but he trumped you.
He had to trump me because he was the patient. But I didn't let him trump me too easily.
Well, tell us about the voting system.
Oh, well, you know, when push came to shove, I decided he had 2 votes and I had 1. But push did come to shove many times because we also had big differences on who to tell what was going on and how much to tell to various friends. And he tended to be much more private. So I had to sort of abide by his wishes.
Right. Whether or not to go sit with him when he was having some sort of a procedure at the hospital, which,
right.
You know, many friends, even family members, would want to be there, but the person might not want you there.
Yeah, that was really hard. I sort of felt hurt that he wouldn't want me there, that I wouldn't be sort of an essential part of his coping. But he actually felt very strongly that he could minimize things better if he sort of pretended it wasn't happening. Just read his physics journals and read the newspaper, and that helped him cope. And I finally realized that he wasn't rejecting me, he was, you know, sort of playing to his own best defenses.
Well, it's interesting. So I'm reading the column, and, you know, we've talked about this, and I'm thinking, well, you know, this is sounding like you're really identifying with the Edwards because you're saying, look, not everyone understands that some people don't want you to just come and sit with them and hold their hand when they've gotten a bad diagnosis. They sort of want you to actually maybe even stay away at times and continue, as you said, a normal life, which is what, you know, the Edwards seemed to be telegraphing.
Exactly.
But then you write that when you first heard their decision, you were horrified.
Yes, because I sort of thought he was being selfish and unfair and he should be a husband, not a candidate.
Well, isn't that funny? Because some would say that of you, not knowing that your husband had asked you to go keep working and
right.
Things normal.
Yeah, then I thought about her, which reminded me of Tom, and I thought, well, yeah, from her point of view, let's keep going. I mean, it's her campaign, too. I think people who've gotten new bad news really kind of want to get back to quote-unquote normal as fast as possible, and I could understand that once I thought about her as opposed to him.
As we know, it feels as if there are going to be so many Americans who are having the same conversation because they've been through it.
Oh, absolutely, which is why I think there's been such an outpouring of support and criticism because so many people are in this situation. But unlike the Edwardses, most of the rest of us don't have to worry about the rest of the world. We basically just have to take our own family into account.
What do you say to people who criticize John Edwards, you know, who say he's exploiting the situation?
I think a lot depends on the prognosis, which, of course, is unknown. But she could live for 8 or 10 years. Then why shouldn't he run or potentially be president? If she's got shorter than that, maybe it's not feasible. And the problem is you don't know. I mean, cancer is really a crapshoot. You can't quite tell. There are people who live with metastatic cancer for a long time. And you wouldn't want to waste those years sort of taking on the sick role or the nurturing role sort of before you have to. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you just can't tell. Mm-hmm.
Judy Foreman, syndicated health columnist. Again, to read her columns, go to our website, here-now.org. Judy, thanks so much for sharing your personal story with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So the Food and Drug Administration has announced that it was a substance in wheat gluten from China that made its way into pet food in America that killed maybe hundreds of pets. Unimaginable that pet owners have to deal with the fact that they fed their beloved pets the very food that killed them. Of course, the death of a beloved animal is not so unimaginable for many of us. I still have not gotten over putting Mo the Chihuahua to sleep at the age of 19. And then a couple months ago, I stayed up overnight with Homie the Terrier and realized, as he went in agony, that I'd waited too long. Well, poet and essayist Mark Doty would understand. His newly released memoir, Dog Years, tells his and the universal story of loving and losing dogs. We sent our intern, Austin Mayfield, to meet Mark at the Fresh Pond Dog Run in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mark's dogs were named Arden and Beau, but as he writes, the relationship wasn't about ownership. So Austin asked, what is it?
What is that? Companionship? Friendship? A kind of agreement? And a very curious kind of agreement, because when we make that sort of pact with another person, they can tell us who they are and what they feel and what they need. But when you enter into that sort of bond with a dog, you agree to be an interpreter of the dog's needs and wishes. And I mean, that's a really fascinating role.
Tell us about what led you to writing this particular memoir.
I lived with two big dogs, Arden, who was a Newfoundland lab mix who made it to the ripe old age of 16, and Beau, a golden retriever who lived to about 10. So that they were with me all together for 16 years, which is a huge chunk of anyone's life. And I thought it would be really interesting to tell their stories at the same time as I might meditate about that kind of relationship. Millions upon millions of people love dogs. Why is that? And so this book is in part an attempt to consider those perennial questions about what it means to care for the non-human. Everybody winces a little, I think, in the face of calendars of cute puppies and kittens on sweatshirts. And it's not that I have anything against cute. It's more that sentimental approach edits out some of the depth and intensity of feeling that animals bring out in us. One of them is the intensity of feeling for a creature which, you know, doesn't live in the world of words. And when you look into a dog's eyes, there is no conceptual framework in between those eyes and yours. There's simply that attention, and we long for that.
You talk about actually a list of 7 things that make a dog endearing to humans, and I think my favorite thing is the fact that they don't judge. If you could read that part.
Sure. So here's a little bit about dogs and judgment. Much has been said of the dog's nearly absolute refusal of judgment. You never have to dress up for them. They have no sense of human social status. They care nothing about race, economic level, gender, sexual orientation, or any human form of privilege. How useful Arden and Beau were to me after my partner Wally died. Not only because their daily needs kept me tethered to the ordinary world of responsibility and schedules, but because I could talk and cry to them for half the day, and they didn't mind in the least, never found me morbid or fixated, and never once indicated that I should get over it.
Mark Doty reading from his memoir, Dog Years, and the pleasure that you talk about in having dogs. I've never had a dog, but I did have a Drake duck.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
great.
It was a great experience, and the memories I have about Cassio, was his name, are similar to what you echo in the book, and it's almost like having a child, but without the same level of expectation. I mean, is that another reason we like dogs?
Well, you know, our dogs and our ducks will never grow up in the sense of they will not become independent of us. That's a curious thing, you know, because people are often put off by too much dependence. But with an animal, that dependence has a certain permanent charm.
Earlier in the book, you mentioned that owning a pet is education in the work of grieving. What did you mean by that?
when we agree to love a creature who does not live as long as we do, we understand that we are signing on for loss. This book is called Dog Years, in part, of course, because of that famous equation of six or seven dog years equaling one human year. They move in the arc of time more rapidly than we do. And to love a dog is this, to watch time pass with a kind of heightened speed. And part of the human stewardship of an animal life involves deciding when that life will end. You know, there are few domestic animals in this country who die of natural causes. You know, we make decisions about the end of life in a way that we very seldom do with human beings. Caring and caretaking brings grief with it, of course, but it also brings real joy.
Now, the story is sort of bookended in your experiences in New York City at the time of the 9/11 attacks.
Right.
And in part of it, you discuss understanding that tragedy a little bit because of your interactions with grief and loss on the individual level. And then you even talk about Arden's response to what happened in 9/11.
Yes. I could see the fall of the towers, but to actually try to imagine those almost 3,000 individual lives, who can do it? We know loss through the particular, through the individual body. And, you know, I had just started this book when I thought, oh, Mark, how on earth now can you write a book about dogs in the face of what has happened? How dare you, really? And it took me a while to be able to come back to my pages and think, no, every love has its place, and every experience of loss connects for us to every other experience. And my grief for losing my golden retriever truly can be a lens through which I can imagine the loss of any body, of any individual presence in the world. We tend to trivialize our grief for animals, and it's kind of odd secret in American life that people feel that loss so profoundly. And of course, you know, our friends say, oh, get another dog. But for many, many people, they are as deep a wound as any loss we know.
You mentioned that as you tried to stop the writing about it, it sort of pushed itself forward. What is that energy about loss that causes us to want to express it?
When we are filled with joy, it isn't our first response to try to understand it. When something hurts, you want to get at the root of that discomfort. And so writing out of loss is a way of literally coming to terms and at least have a little power over it by naming it.
Right now, there is no dog, but is there a new dog on the horizon? Do you see it anytime
soon? Oh, I think so. I think of myself as between dogs right now, and there are a number of reasons for that. One is that Arden and Beau were big presences in my life. I feel like those are big paws to fill, you know? This is also a point in my life where there's lots of travel, but I have faith that, the right dog is headed in my direction, and I know when that happens, I won't be saying no.
Mark Doty, the author of the new memoir, Dog Years. Mark, thank you so much.
My pleasure. This was fun.
Here now is Austin Mayfield with poet and author Mark Doty speaking about his new book, Dog Years. Here now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin, also Between Dogs, Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.